It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Make podcasts great again. Strike up the band!
The half-life of these individual slogans is reducing.
Because I don't think there's anything that the Liberal Democrats stand for that you couldn't have as an opinion and be in the shadow cabinet.
Well, yeah. Spotted, Denny.
Thank you.
Yes, here we are again. Then it's How to Win an Election, your insider's guide to the huge political year ahead. I'm Matt Chorley, joined in the studio by New Labour mastermind Peter Mandelson, Polly McKenzie, Policy McKenzie, Nick Clegg's former brain, and Tory brain box Daniel Finkelstein. How are we all?
Very well, thank you, Matt. How are you?
Tip top. I've got a cup of tea in my Andrew Bridgen mug.
Oh, great.
I think of all the jokes, because of his potato business, calling him Spud You Don't Like.
Spud You Hate.
It was...
You think that might be the pinnacle of my career?
I think that was the pinnacle of my career.
Terrific. If you want to get in touch with us, don't forget you can email us howtowin@thetimes.co.uk, howtowin@thetimes.co.uk, and we'll do some of your questions a bit later on. We're going to take a look at some by-elections, because there's two more on the way. They just keep on coming, and at least another one to follow. But I want to talk about an election. First of all, we should talk about Taiwan, Polly. You were correct to point our minds on the first big election of the year.
Yeah, so the DPP, which was the previously ruling party, has won with a plurality, 40% of the vote, which means that there will be a new president, Lai. He's currently the vice president in May. They are the party who are most Western aligned, as it were. So it's probably not great news for Beijing, who would like to see, you know, a clearer alignment.
And specifically said, you know, China was explicit in saying, don't vote for this guy.
Yeah, then they believe that Taiwan belongs to China. And so, Peter, last time we talked about this, Peter made the point that from a kind of global peace perspective, maintaining this slightly awkward status quo is what we would like. It doesn't feel like a recipe for immediate escalation of tensions, but equally, it remains quite a tricky relationship there.
I think it's quite a good result because Mr. Lai has won. Mm-hmm. So that sends a strong message to Beijing, sort of hands off. But he hasn't actually done that well. I mean, you say he has a plurality of vote. He does not have a majority.
No, only 40%.
He has to govern with others. And this will constrain him somewhat, and I think that's a healthy outcome.
Yeah, yeah. So in terms of... Well, it's good. With everything else that's going on in the world, that not becoming a flashpoint is we can chalk that up as a win. What about what's happening in America? Donald Trump overnight winning by a landslide in Iowa in the first contest in the race to become the Republican nominee. Danny, can you see any way where this isn't a Biden-Trump rematch?
It's looking very much like that. Look, you know, one of the things I would say is I'm not an actuary, so, and they're both very old, so who knows whether or not they'll fight with each other. So you'd be made, you know, and that is one of the few things that
literally
can...
Literally a fight to the finish.
Exactly. I think that's one of the few things that can derail this contest now. But, and people should take it. So I had a lot of people, at Christmas, I wrote that I thought the prospect of Donald Trump as the next president was one of the big issues for the world in the next 12 months. And lots of people wrote to me saying, don't be ridiculous, he can't possibly be elected. And, you know, he's looking very strong to be the Republican candidate. And if you are the Republican candidate in a year where there's a Democrat president, you most certainly can be elected. So nobody who listens to this should think to themselves, because of all the court cases, because they think Donald Trump isn't all there, or because of the things that he said, he cannot win. He absolutely, what this result showed last night, for all the speculation about, you know, potential surge for Nikki Haley and that sort of thing, he won comfortably, and you know, the weather and all these other minor factors haven't put people off, because he's very strong with the Republicans. He is, and Republicans will turn out to vote for him, at least partly because they don't want the Democrats in lots of different ways. And we should take very seriously the idea that he could be re-elected.
We actually asked YouGov to ask British voters who they would rather see win the US election. 18% said Donald Trump, 56% said Joe Biden. But interestingly, support for Donald Trump was highest amongst Tory voters in 2019, 28% of those. Leave voters, the same, so more than a quarter. Almost a quarter of men, so 23% of men wanted Donald Trump, only 12% of women. Interestingly, it was marginally higher in terms of support for Donald Trump amongst 18 to 24-year-olds. And then it sort of gradually went down to the age, in the age groups, down to 15% amongst the over 65.
So it's an interesting thing about young voters, which is, you know, interesting for all other elections. Though it's true that young voters can be more the most left-wing group, they can also be the most right-wing group. So the group in the United States that was the most in favour of the Vietnam War throughout, including when the Vietnam War became impossibly difficult later, were young people. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the reasons why big civil wars happen mainly in countries which have large proportions of young men in them, that figure that you've given.
I think this is because a lot of young people just do not want to vote for politicians who seem to have come from central casting. I mean, it's why I think a lot of young people supported Jeremy Corbyn. Mm. He was a sort of anti-politician. And the same goes for Trump. I mean, I was listening to some of his supporters on the radio this morning, you know, crowing over his victory. Why do they think he's so wonderful? Because he's not a politician, they said. He's sent by God, you know, or whatever. But, you know, he's not central casting. And people are fed up with sort of identikit politicians, and that's why I think many young people turn to people like that.
There is also more broadly research about the enthusiasm for democracy over dictators, or people, you know, the younger people seem less enthusiastic about the concept of democracy.
I think it's another reminder of how fragile democracy is, of things that were taken for granted. People always have a go at Francis Fukuyama for writing a book about the end of history. I used to run a think tank, Demos, and we actually published a paper called The End of Politics as well around that time.
Wow.
The sort of sense that liberal democracy had won and everything was going to be fine, and really it was just sort of a tidying up exercise for the rest of the world.
That nothing was in contention anymore. You didn't need to contest. You know,
Tony Blair solved the problem between left and right politics and come up with a third way, and everything was going to be fine. I mean, that's just arrogant nonsense, isn't it?
Oh, which we can all... It wasn't fine.
I'm not trying to be mean about Tony Blair on this occasion, so don't worry.
But everything, you know, got better.
Trump is a threat to democracy, and he is a threat to global stability. You know, who knows what he would do with respect to support for Ukraine? Who knows what he would do with support for Israel? Might be more, might be less. Who knows? Who knows how he would behave with Taiwan and
what
with
he would
North
do
Korea?
For China? You know, I think Trump's perfectly capable of saying, you know, Xi Jinping, well, you know, I can get along with him. He's a bit like me. He's sort of economic nationalist, populist, authoritarian politician with, you know, with those tendencies. I can do business with him, he might say, rather than go to war with him.
The real danger, I think, in Trump is whether or not he is more focused this time. First of all, he's obviously more seized of the idea that the system is opposed to him and is corrupt and crooked in various different ways. But secondly, last time, you know, his impact was fortunately blunted by the fact that he kept on sacking, you know, he sacked people all the time and therefore never had any continuity of anything that he was doing. If he were more focused, he could be more dangerous. But I think you're right, both of you, that young people are less struck by the benefits of democracy for all sorts of reasons, one of which obviously is that liberal capitalism hasn't worked for them in the same way that it has worked for other generations. But it's also because, I'm sure all three of us have this experience, you are more certain you're right when you're younger. And as you grow older, you do get a bit of perception that there are other opinions. You become a little bit more open to pluralism. I think that is definitely an explanation.
It's neurobiological, right? Like, younger people's brains work differently. Their neurons fire differently. Fortunately, we're all terribly old here.
We haven't got any new ones left.
Young people, they have a different, what's called discount rate. Like, how much do you value gains that you will make 5, 10, 15 years from now? You just value them differently than you do when you are older. Mm. And that's why young people save less for their retirement than middle-aged people.
So it's just your approach to things. Peter, on How to Win last week, you talked about the impact you thought that Trump's campaign and popularity and approach and style might influence the Tory campaign. And clearly, a quarter of their voters would like to see him back. That might be a bit of that. But what about Keir Starmer? What does he have to do? It was notable, both Keir Starmer and David Lammy at the weekend, being very careful not to go sort of studs up on Trump, because they know that come the end of the year, or early next year, they might have to be working with him.
Yes, by the end of this year, you may have Prime Minister Starmer having to do business with President Trump. So, of course, he's not going to go studs up at this stage. I mean, he would be very ill-advised, as would David Lammy, you know, to start sort of expressing personal views about Trump. I mean, in the context of Israel and Gaza, similarly, by the end of this year, if Netanyahu is still in charge in Israel, you may have if he's elected, a Prime Minister Starmer having to do business with Netanyahu. You know, don't speak ill of people you're going to have to sort of deal with and treat with if the opportunity opens up.
Can I ask you, how easy or difficult is that within the Labour coalition? So Rishi Sunak, in my view, will have a problem as the election comes closer because of the American election going on at the same time. Donald Trump is making populist noises. It may be even attractive. There is this 28% you talked about who will think Rishi Sunak is not achieving what he could because he's not doing what Donald Trump... In other words, he'll be pulled in that direction. How easy is the position you're recommending, which I agree with? It's difficult enough for Keir Starmer to take up. It's difficult enough for Theresa May, to be honest, to have that thing where she went to see Donald Trump and there was that famous incident of him grasping her hand as he went down the stairs, or he went down the ramp, actually. So how easy is it? What's your assessment? Do you think that he'd face really quite a lot of difficulty cooperating with President Trump from the left, from the centre to the left of the party?
Well, that's so it's not a question of what you say before you become prime minister or have to deal with him. It's what you do if you're in office. I think he will come under pressure, but at the same time, people know that there is a national interest, there's a British interest. The United States is our key global ally. We have, for the time being, God knows how long it will last under President Trump, you know, a very important security guarantee given to us through NATO by the United States. But there will be Ukraine, Israel, there may be other global hotspots where we're having to take a view, and we find Trump's approach really troublesome. I mean, really difficult. So he'll have to navigate his way through that. I mean, last week, Danny, I thought you rather poured scorn on me for saying that having a campaign running at the same time, Trump and Sunak wouldn't be that brilliant for Sunak. I mean, I still think...
No, I would never pour scorn on you. That's the first point to establish. secondly, I wrote this. I wrote over Christmas that it will be a problem. It will be a problem. I don't think any of these things, by the way, are election determining issues.
It's why, by the way, I'm not sure that November the 14th is such an ideal election date for Rishi Sunak to choose, because his entire campaign will be running alongside and be sort of completely, almost sort of sort of overlap with Trump's, and the whole media sort of maelstrom is going
and,
to.
And as we've seen, you know, when you've got your Lee Addisons and all that out saying, you know, it's been more choppy. That seems to be working. Than it
I mean, if I was Sunak and was going to go for an autumn election, I think I'd prefer to go in October rather than November for that.
Sure,
for
but it does close because the issue of the American alliance is so essential to our defence, and William Hague is very good on this, arguing, talking about Taiwan, for example, this morning, and Yemen, because it's so critical. Anybody who is serious about becoming prime minister will face big questions about it, and those questions will rise in the 6 months. I don't think this is going to be an election outcome determining election. But, and it certainly puts questions for Sunak, but it'll also put some questions for Starmer as well.
It's also the great risk, though, as you say, America is central to our defence, our security, in all the ways that you've articulated. But the risk is that under Trump, at some point, that stops being as true.
Yeah,
we will need to find ways to realign and seek security with our friends and neighbours in Europe in a different way.
Than that. Because I think whoever is president, to a greater or lesser extent, we are going to be able to depend on the United States less and less for our security and defence because of the way the United States is going. We are going to have to step up, we in Europe and Britain. Yes. We're going to step up, do more, and look after ourselves in ways that we haven't really imagined ourselves doing since the Second World War.
Clearly, you know, the global security, the future of who's in the White House, all very important matters. But more importantly, Danny, it's been a week now. Davey hasn't taken your advice.
He hasn't. And it's interesting. You know, my advice...
You suggested he should resign last week.
My advice is obviously influenced by something Liberal Democrats don't agree with, which is that I think intrinsically the position that he is inhabiting, being leader of the Liberal Democrats, isn't as valuable as he thinks it is. Because I think that while Liberal democracy is important, it could just as easily be in Labour. That didn't underpin, and I understand why Liberal Democrats didn't like that. But it was actually meant as advice to them. I think that they would be better off with him having taken a very brave, big position on the post office, showing how Liberal Democrat values really are implemented and put in practice, meanwhile allowing someone else to lead the party. I think the difference is marginal. I think
Danny said something also very important last week.
Thank you.
Which is that barely anyone in the country's heard of it.
Correct. Yeah.
And they've not. I mean, okay, they will have clocked this, but whether it makes a seismic difference to their judgment of him, I think is a different question.
And crucially, it accepts the premise of the issue that there is one person to blame. This is a structural failing for all parties, for the whole of the state. And actually, Ed Davey, if he did that, would be playing into the hands of the Conservative Party and Labour Party, who have both tried to say that it wasn't them.
Yeah. I think he could argue.
We want to hang on to listeners.
I just want to say, I think he could argue. I think if he resigned, he could make exactly that point, but with greater power.
For three seconds.
Stop talking about Ed Davey.
Disappeared from the airwaves forever.
Yeah. Right. Nonsense. Well, we'll talk about one of Ed Davey's subjects he's happy to talk about. We're going to talk about by elections next. We've got at least two, possibly three coming down the track. How do you win one, and what difference does it make? We'll do that next on How to Win an Election.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify.
Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
It's Matt Chorley with How to Win an Election, joined by Peter Madison, Polly McKenzie and Daniel Finkelstein. Right, let's turn our attention to the main business of the week then. We want to talk about by-elections. We've got two by-elections definitely coming, one in Wellingborough following the recall of Peter Bone, one in Kingswood following the resignation of Chris Skidmore. They're both happening on February the 15th. And another one looms in Blackpool South, where Scott Benton is currently the Conservative MP, but he is facing suspension from Parliament following that Times investigation that he offered to ask questions in return for money for the gambling industry. So if his suspension goes through, there's likely to be another recall petition, and it's like, which history suggests, will trigger another one. We've already had 16 by-elections in this current Parliament. Polly, they're a big... the Lib Dems love them, don't they?
Well, what's great about by-elections is they're massively different sort of contests than a general election. Because the one obvious thing is that the future of the country is not at stake, which means you get a number of things. One, you tend to get much lower turnout. You also can get much bigger swings. And you can shift the political kind of mood in a place because it's so concentrated and people can safely sort of send a message to the government. Mm. And so whether it is about a local thing, you know, which might be some, there's a field that somebody wants to build some houses on, which you can sort of turn into a big issue, or whether it's the Iraq war or a particular terrorism vote or getting police on our streets, you can just turn it into a sort of single issue referendum on whether the government's any good. And out of that, which is not really a sort of, it's not in any way comparable to a general election, and yet it has meaning in the sort of SW1 bubble to the sort of the political parties, to their leaders, to their MPs and to the journalists, which means that out of this sort of weird thing, you can create momentum in the real thing. You can look like a victor, you can have cheering people, you can look happy, and it can change a narrative for good or ill about whether you're winning and losing, and also what kind of policies, what kind of things are winning and losing. We saw after the Uxbridge by-election, which I think has sent the Conservatives even more mad, unfortunately, the a belief that, oh, well, because in Uxbridge we held on to, the Conservatives held on to that because of the ULEZ, therefore we must turn ending the war on the motorist into our core election platform.
Yeah, which shouldn't last very long. I mean, so my view of
like
is,
all his strategies,
actual elections are, and like local elections actually are important because they are about how people locally are governed or represented. So they're very important in themselves. But as indicators of national opinion, while they give you a taste of it, they're nowhere near as good as an opinion poll. I mean, you would never conduct an opinion poll by saying we're going to concentrate on one constituency, let everyone do an unfeasibly large amount of voter contact, pose them a completely different question, which is who do you want your MP to be your MP, rather than simply the question of who do you want to be Prime Minister, which is a different question. Organise it at a completely different time to everything else, you'd get a terrible result, which is what you do. So I don't think we take them incredibly seriously, and we think they're important. They're important in themselves. They're national elections that are worthy of covering because a Member of Parliament is important. But as indicators of national opinion, except in the crudest way, you know, but if the crude way these by-elections are, the crude piece of information these by-elections I can exclusively reveal are going to, and on our podcast is going to tell us, is the Tories aren't doing very well, which we already know.
Yeah, they may not be scientific, Danny, but they do create momentum. And they do have...
Give me some examples. They do except have... Darlington. Darlington, where Ossie O'Brien beat Tony Cook just near to the election, which may have stopped the SDP going past Labour in 1983. Just because it had come after, I think, the... one other party, maybe
no,
Greenwich.
No, no, no. Bermondsey was before it, which was a big nail in Michael Foot's coffin. And Greenwich was in February 1987.
Later, where that really stymied Labour's momentum.
But give me an example. Going into the general election in that year.
I don't believe it did.
Oh, believe me, I was there.
But if you look at a poll, I just think it's over. So this is an important
topic. I suppose it's whether or not it's a cause and effect thing. Is it just an important symptom of what's already happening?
This is an important debate for our... Because earlier we were talking about all sorts of different subjects, all of which I think, like the American elections, or indeed the question we were discussing with the Liberal Democrat leader I'm not allowed to mention anymore in this programme. These don't affect the big results, because very few things really do. And I just think the impact of some by-election...
I'm not saying that the Labour would have won the general election of 1987 had it not been for Greenwich that February. But I tell you what it did. We were unfortunately faced with a selection of a, quotes, hard left, quotes, loony left candidate, Deirdre Wood, who was a great sort of Livingstone person. And Kinnock's whole appeal that he had been created was that he had defeated the hard left, defeated militant, he'd turned around the Labour Party, and there was the pops up, Deirdre Wood. And I remember what Neil said to me. He said, I'm afraid it's Deirdre, Pete, do what you can in that by-election. Well, we did everything that we could and lost. And I'm afraid what it seemed to bring home to the public was actually Labour still mired in hard leftery, and it did do us damage. I mean, it arrested the momentum we were building up to that election. So as I say, it didn't determine the outcome of the general election, but it certainly affected us as a party.
I think it's because of the impact that it has within the people who are hyper interested in politics. People always in the kind of the commentary after a by-election in the morning, 3 a.m. in the morning, they're always saying, oh, this proves what I already believed. which, you can always post hoc rationalise a by-election. But that means that organising factions within a party have new evidence for the thing they always believed. And so it can be very destabilising to your campaigning, your coalition, your organising capability. And that's why it has an effect. It's why it has such a mobilising effect for the Liberal Democrats, because plenty of people, such as Danny, believe they don't really have any reason to exist. But there's nothing like winning a by-election to make you feel like you do deserve to exist. And so that means that at the next election, or just whatever, the next week, more people delivering leaflets, more people being enthusiastic, and that ability to mobilise and enthuse, or on the other hand, kind of destabilise and drive factionalism, is incredibly important.
As a receptacle for anti-Tory votes, by the way, of course the Liberal Democrats should exist. It's just a question of whether they need to be separate from Labour. That's the question.
To be fair to Ed Davey. Which is completely different to being fair to
Ed Miliband. But I just think... I very, very much doubt that data analysis would vindicate the idea. I think these things are noise, they're not signal. So I think what's going to drive the election is it's time for a change. The Conservative Party has moved to having a coalition that doesn't suit lots of seats in the country that it holds. And this will demonstrate that, so we'll learn it anew. But we already, a reasonable view of the political situation tells us this already. What are we going to learn from these by-elections that we don't know?
Is it also partly because we've had a lot of them, and we can see the opinion polls are so stark. They're actually, at this moment, they're less useful. I was just sort of thinking about sort of David Cameron, after Gordon Brown became Prime Minister, 2007, 2009, at various points, David Cameron got into trouble or whatever. And actually winning Crewe in Nantwich was the first big sort of notable electoral test after Gordon Brown's wobble. And the Tories took that off of Labour. And it showed that David Cameron could gain seats.
But it was entirely obvious, right? I mean, we had the opinion...
But then there were other ones he didn't win.
If you wanted to find out what people thought, you would conduct a survey. You wouldn't say, let's only ask the people of Crewe and Nantwich.
But not everyone.
Danny, you're missing something. There's a sort of political dynamic involved in all this, not just a sort of taking the temperature of the electorate or a scientific poll. Look, between 1992 and 1997, we had what I think something in the region of 8 or 9 by-elections. The Conservatives lost each and every one of them. So it wasn't just noise, it was a signal that they were sort of in decline and possibly finished. But it also told the electorate that you can find the most viable anti-Tory candidate and back them. So half those by-election victories went to the Liberal Democrats, half of them went to Labour. Tactical voting, in other words, became entrenched. And that's exactly what we're seeing in this Parliament since 2019. We've had, about 10 by-elections or so. They've almost entirely been won by alternatives to the Conservatives, not all of them. Hartlepool was an exception. Mm. And I can tell you, Hartlepool, yes, by the way, had a very major strategic impact on Labour. And I can come back to that. But tactical voting is becoming more entrenched, more habitual amongst voters. And by-elections sort of tell you, they school you in the art and of tactical voting. Think about Hartlepool by-election. I mean, Polly very rightly pointed to Uxbridge and its significance on the Tories and Tory strategy, short-lived as it was. The loss by Labour of Hartlepool in 2021.
May, yeah.
Was really significant for Labour. It was a shock. It shook up Keir Starmer and his entire team. If you remember, the conclusion he drew from it was that he had to really shake up in quite a ruthless way his top team. It affected his deputy leader.
That's when he carried out a ruthless reshuffle and accidentally gave Angela Rayner 5 job titles.
Yes, but it did remove Angela from a crucial role, which was chair of the party. But even more significant than that, it changed sort of Annalise Dodds from shadow chancellor to Rachel Reeves. And if you don't think that wasn't the most significant personnel change that we've seen during this Parliament, I'd like to know what it is. It also led to him shaking up his own sort of personal team. It led in time to Morgan McSweeney, his tough, ruthless operator, becoming campaign director. It really had a big impact, did Hartlepool, just as in a more short-lived way Uxbridge had for the Tories.
The reality is that not everybody in politics is as clever or as analytical as Danny. And again, humans are weird, right? We don't all learn in a sort of strategic and rational kinds of way. Lots of us humans, but people in politics as well, learn in different way. They learn through experience. And there's something about an election decision which can crystallise, which can become a sort of focal moment where something that was, of course, obvious in the data if you thought about it properly, becomes so obviously true that it changes minds and you wake up with a sudden dawning realisation. And that's because we're humans. It's because we exist in narratives and not always in data.
There's also a practical element, isn't it? In a general election year, all the parties will be using different slogans, leaflet design, door-knocking strategies.
By-elections are dry runs.
Dress rehearsals, yeah.
They're dry dress rehearsals. I mean,
so in that way, obviously, they do matter. And I can understand the impact on internal narratives. So if Labour, if Keir Starmer had not picked before Hartlepool the message that he was caught between a number of different messages and had selected people designed to give people a little clue of where he stood and he had to choose, then I'm amazed that he hadn't. And maybe it did have an impact upon him.
But maybe he knew and couldn't pull it off because not enough
That's a very good point. But also it changed Keir Starmer in this way, Danny. He had been a unity first man before Hartlepool. And, let's all be friends. And yes, I've replaced Jeremy Corbyn, but he's still there in the party. I tell you, what Hartlepool brought home to Starmer and everyone else was that how that sort of Corbyn long Corbyn was sort of cast over would-be Labour voters, and that was not sustainable. And when you had all the anti-Semitism stuff and the report that was unveiled, from that flowed a judgment that Labour would not recover amongst former and would-be Labour voters unless we dealt much more decisively with Jeremy Corbyn. And that also flowed from the Hartlepool by-election.
Okay, I thought it was obvious, but you know, I think that was entirely obvious.
If we do have three more by-elections, if Rishi Sunak loses them all, and they're all in sort of different sorts of seats,
he will lose them all.
Yeah, rural, you know, market town, coastal area. Doesn't that just create even more instability amongst his MPs?
Of course, but I mean,
and loss of authority for Rishi Sunak.
Rightly or wrongly, some Tory MPs will be even more fretful.
And they will use that as a reason to do it. But I mean, if you think that removing or attacking Rishi Sunak will help the Conservative Party win or do better at the next general election, neither of which I do think, then obviously you'll use this. But you have enough evidence already that that's exactly what's going to happen.
The truth is that by-elections can have major personal consequences. As I know from my personal experience, I literally was made, my whole political career was launched and made in the Brecon and Radnor by-election in 1985. I volunteered from my role as a TV producer on Weekend World and went to be the candidate's aide, and there I was spotted. And I was 2 months later catapulted into my position. From Brecon to Southwark, I joined the Labour Party headquarters in Walworth Road and became its Director of Campaigns and Communications. And then the following year, at the Knowsley North by-election, this ridiculous story about me and Mushy Pease was born. If you remember, people said that when I was seeking the selection in Hartlepool, I went into a Hartlepool fish and chip shop and mistook Mushy Pease for guacamole. I mean, you know, as if I... And that, of course, was a completely apocryphal story. Yeah. It was, in fact, an American intern in the Knowsley North by-election in 1986 who went into a fish and chip shop and asked for the guacamole. And for some reason, which I've never since been able to understand...
It just seems so out of character.
They just thought that that was a story that just fitted so perfectly with me. And it's been attached to me like a legend ever since.
We should point out, Peter, that you were so successful in Brecon and Radnor. It was a Conservative seat then won by the Liberals.
Yeah, but it was one of... No, come on.
It was
on.
That sort of winning streak it that was, Neil Kinnock thought, was, he's the man I want.
It was one of those brilliant by-election campaigns when we sort of shook the tree through the strength of our campaign, but the apples fell into the Liberal Democrat basket.
Right, very good. That was a caring, sharing approach to politics. Very good. Right, enough questions from me. Let's do some questions that have been emailed in. Kieran has emailed in to howtowin@thetimes.co.uk. Listening through the podcast has been insightful, and I hope someone could answer a question, he said. When following American elections, there seems a media emphasis on core states where elections can be won or lost, which then serve as a political battleground during those elections. Looking forward to towards our own election, could the cast identify any core constituencies which could serve a similar purpose? What's a sort of seat for us to keep an eye on?
Would Hartlepool be one, Peter?
Hartlepool is important because it's a so-called red wall seat that we had until the by-election in 2021 held since, you know, 1959. But the wider lesson of this is this, very clearly. The challenge that Keir Starmer faces now is completely different from the one that Tony Blair faced in 1997. In 1997, basically, Labour held almost all its sort of core heartland constituencies. We had sort of rebuilt in successive general elections, and by the time we got to 1997, Tony Blair was sort of adding the sort of painting and decorating to the heavy lifting that actually had already been done by Neil Kinnock. This time, Keir Starmer, we've got to do two things. We've not only got to win back those sort of swing constituencies, you know, which with all those sort of, you know, centrist would be possibly Tory voters who we've got to appeal to. We've got to extend our reach to those sort of marginal swing constituencies, but we've also got to regain all those heartland constituencies like Hartlepool that we lost in 2019. So it's a sort of double whammy, a double task that Keir Starmer faces, which is why he's facing a much bigger challenge now than we faced in 1997.
To look at in the right place, don't just look at the marginals. The marginals are going to go Labour or Liberal Democrat. Look much further up the beachhead. That would be my advice for the general election. So because I think that's where the battle is going to take place. So it's in seats where the Conservatives hold, you know, with relatively reasonable majorities of 10,000 or so. So actually, in fact, you know, there were a list of cabinet members with large majorities where there was a question mark over them. Because of the particular people who hold those, they'll hold public attention. Maybe they're good areas to comment on.
I think if Labour is going to get a majority, they don't have to just take seats from the Conservatives. They actually also have to regain Scotland. They have to make advances in Wales. And also, there's a question of whether those Lib Dem, Tory, more marginals, are those going to fall in numbers to the Liberal Democrats, which just sort of, that's where you might get a real catastrophe for the Conservatives if they're not just losing to Labour, but they're losing everywhere. So, you know, Isher and Walton, Dominic Raab's seat, is one where Liberal Democrats made substantial gains last time. Would they take that? You know, that would suggest that the Conservatives will be losing everywhere rather than just to Labour. Yeah,
yeah. And just to give a sense of the scale, there's been this new analysis out this week on the new boundaries and the seats and what they look like. If you get down to the top 50 targets of Labour, Darlington is one of them, is the number 50. You only need a swing of 5.36% to take that. But to get a majority is, what, 12%? So, there's basically...
That's a big swing, by the way.
Yeah, 5% is a big swing in normal times.
Labour has a huge mountain to climb.
And on that note, that was Peter Manison, Polly McKenzie, Daniel Finkstein. I was Matt Chorley. That was How to Win an Election.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.